Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. In today's world, integrity workers work in silos at different companies. They're often inhibited by NDAs from sharing best practices and resources with one another. One particular missing resource is a taxonomy of harms. Not only that, but specific interventions and the trade-offs associated with those harms. Enter today's guest, Grady Ward. He is building the Wikipedia of integrity. We discuss common harms, impactful mitigations, and of course, success stories. In typical Trust in Tech fashion, we also discuss the tensions and synergies between integrity and privacy, and if you stick around to the end, you can hear about some musings on the interplay of art and nature. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Grady.
Thanks for having me.
For sure. So let's get started with this visiting fellowship project that you had, a taxonomy of harms.
Yeah, for sure. So it's definitely a taxonomy of harms. It's also a taxonomy of features and potential interventions. And the kind of core thesis of the project is that digital harms largely come from platform design as opposed to the content that underlies it. And then that platform design is malleable, right? We can regulate it, we can change it. And I built this as a resource to try and engender more conversation about design as a source of harms and also place where we can intervene to prevent harm.
Got it. And what broad buckets of harms are there? And then we can go into like what responsible design mechanisms you can have to mitigate them.
Yeah, for sure. I think that every harm is sufficiently different that it warrants kind of individual discussion. So like I didn't think about this project so much as trying to bucket harms together as trying to connect them to features. So I think there's something like 40 different types of harms on the platform. And I tried to write up an intelligible summary of, you know, here are the kind of core pieces of what constitutes this harm and how it is perpetrated and how it is motivated. And then from that perspective, saying, okay, and how does the platform aid in the contribution of that harm, right? So some harms are kind of neutral to platform design choices or additional functionality. So a good example there is like blackmail, right? Platforms might enable blackmail to have more reach, but it doesn't actually add any like additional capacity for a person to perpetrate blackmail against someone else. A very different category of harm is something like non-consensually explicit imagery, right? Or NCEI, which is revenge porn is the outdated term there. That's something where a platform actually plays a pretty significant role in contributing to the harm by providing an environment in which people can find, share, disseminate, and ultimately cause the harm through the distribution of that type of content. And so the reason I like thinking about that kind of question of what role does the platform play in adding to the harm that is going to occur is because it tries to separate out the question of who is responsible for like the motivation of the content versus who is responsible for the outcomes, right? And I find that to be a really useful approach.
So I'm assuming in this case, the motivation of the content would be probably the user, and the platform is in a specific dark pattern scenario, the platform can appropriate some of the blame there.
Yeah, we tend to understate the degree to which platforms contribute to harm in my mind, right? So, you know, if you have something like allowing anonymous uploads of images, then the platform is much more liable in my mind for the contribution to NCEI than if all images when uploaded have really significant attribution data, right? And like that is actually a kind of subtle design choice around what types of content you allow and what types of user interaction you allow. But, you know, it's pretty clear when you think about it through that frame that like there's going to be more illegal, dangerous, and malicious content shared on sites where there's, you know, highly anonymous accounts or where creating accounts is very easy than on platforms where those two things are harder.
Yeah, and I think this would be an interesting question to bring up here, but what features have you noticed bring up the most harms on these platforms?
Yeah, for sure. This is a great question. So as we were talking about earlier, like, you know, the harm taxonomy is kind of the first part of this project. And then it tries to tie each harm to what types of features are, you know, amplifying or helping to construct that harm. The one that I think is pretty concerning overall is recommendation. And the reason I think that that is the most concerning element is it's the piece that is most attributable to the platform itself, right? So something like messaging is a context in which like one user is initiating an action that has an intended effect on another user, and that is somewhat of like a standard set of features that doesn't have any type of like platform volition involved, right? And whereas with something like recommendation or search, a platform has a huge amount of discretion and volition over what types of content it recommends and a huge amount of discretion over what order users see content that they subscribe to. And I think in each of those cases, the platform plays a much more significant role in the causal chain that leads to harm than they do in cases where the intent of the user is being clearly expressed without alteration through a platform.
You're bringing up an interesting point. You're saying that this is one of the recommendations, is one of the features that you can ascribe a lot more of the blame to the platform. I guess, is there a correlation between like the amount of blame you can ascribe to a platform with the amount of harm a specific feature can have? Like, for example, let's say like recommendation is like a feature that has, that's obviously like the platform has a lot of volition over. Is it also the case that because of that, there is more harm that can be attributable to that specific feature?
That's a good question. I think that the degree of harm is pretty separable in my mind from the role that a platform plays in it, right? But I do think that the responsibility is correlated, right? So if a platform offers features that have a higher capacity for them to contribute to harm, I think that they have a higher level of responsibility to mitigate that harm. And so a great example here is, you know, I worked on Google Drive for a while. I felt really differently about our obligations to protect users if they are uploading files from their own computer, not sharing it with anyone, and downloading it back to their computer, right? That feels like one level of interaction where the platform is not providing a particularly sophisticated feature, and it's capable of harm, certainly, but it's not capable of like amplifying the harm that is already occurring. In contrast, when we allow a user to publish to the world content, and we know based on metrics that that content is getting hundreds of thousands of views, the platform's playing a really different role in the contribution of potential harm there, right? And so like one of the things that I worked on at Google was trying to kind of make those two more aligned in saying we actually should hold different levels of scrutiny and moderation in trying to balance the privacy element of that and trying to balance the kind of curatorial obligations. And the reason that that's important, right, is precisely because by offering the ability to distribute to 10,000 or 100,000 people, a platform is actually providing additional value. Whereas if it's something like just storage, it's a much more kind of transactional platform agnostic mechanism.
Yeah. Besides recommendation, anything else like really stick out to you too?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the ones that is most promising is comments. I think that the design of comments is one of the most interesting pieces of like how the internet operates across.
Yeah,
the
I guess, like these are both pretty core features, recommendation and comments. I guess like I just have to put the question out there, but like what does a better recommendation look like? What does a better comment system look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think a better recommendation system is something that looks much more like subscription sorting as opposed to something that looks like kind of proactive content recommendation. And I distinguish between those two because I think that like when people select, I want to follow person X, or I want to follow topic X, or I want to see more content from this author, that's a really, really different like level of feedback that the user is providing versus like the platform realizing that you are looking at this photo for slightly longer. Right? Like the level of user input there, I think makes a subscription-based recommendation system much less prone to the types of contributory harm that I'm most concerned about. And then on comments, I think that there's actually a ton of really interesting thoughts on the platform on this, but I love thinking about comments because we think of comments as kind of unitary, but there are so many design choices in comments, right? Can comments be upvoted or downvoted? What order are comments shown in? Are they displayed in a kind of recursive nested order? Are they linear or are they nested? And kind of every single one of those has a ton of implications on the types of comments people get and the value that those comments have to both the primary author and the secondary. And so one of the things that I think Twitter innovated on, and like one of the reasons it like blew up, is that it figured out how to make comments equal in like form to primary content, right? But that also engenders a ton of kind of negative types of social interactions like dunking and like, you know, reply guys. Right? And so I think that like, I think you can explain a lot of the difference across social platforms and like the vibes they have based on the structure of the comments that they provide.
I see. And was there in your research, did you see any harms associated with a particular structure of comments? or a particular structure of ranking?
Yeah. So I think a lot of like temporal based comment systems, so like things that display things in chronological order, in very concrete terms, they incentivize quick replies that aren't very thoughtful. Right? And similarly, comment systems that have some kind of voting mechanism built into them have a significant source of dunking and other types of kind of not antisocial, but not necessarily like contributory.
Not pro-social.
Yeah, not pro-social. But I think that one of the ways that a lot of platforms have tried to make things better and kind of improve their content moderation efforts is to add more signals of user satisfaction and dissatisfaction. When users are happy, it tends to be a signal that the platform is going to optimize for. And when users are unhappy in almost any context, it signals some form of misuse of the platform or misuse of the like of the individual features. But yeah, I'm not an expert on YouTube comments, so please don't hold me to any of that.
Yeah. What metric do you think they've been optimizing? Or like, I guess they've been optimizing user satisfaction.
To be totally transparent, I don't. Google teams are all pretty cagey about what they optimize for and what types of rules they apply to things to try and, you know, make it harder to gain anything. But, you know, a lot of platforms have been figuring out that if they have positive and negative signals, they're able to try to amplify various kinds of content. You know, controversial content tends to perform really well on engagement. And, you know, but controversial is approximately equivalent to upvotes times downvotes or whatever. And then there's a bunch of signals around quality that you can kind of think of as some amount of positive appreciation minus controversy, or algorithms that optimize for a positive signal and optimize against a mixed signal.
I see. Yeah, I think that the incentive structure for YouTube comments is quite different than, like, I don't know, Facebook newsfeed, at least from Facebook's angle, or I guess YouTube comments angle as well. I am curious, though, on this specific ranking mechanisms that are pro-social. In your research, you were going into like kind of like the specifics of quality is some variable minus controversy or something. Did you find any ranking system that was quote unquote pro-social like that, or something that, like, if you had Twitter/X in your newsfeed ranking right now, like in your hands, like, is there something that you could do that would change it, or would you want to change it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty skeptical of our capacity to use ranking as a really positive influence here. And I think a lot of that is because it's so opaque, right? I can't tell you how any algorithm works on any platform, and that's because I'm not internal to those companies. And if I was, we couldn't talk about it, right? And like, I think that one of the things that we need to try and change the conversation around is like, ranking is one part of platform design, but it's a part that's really hard to reason about and see changes as an outsider, or see transparency in, because these platforms are all intentionally very opaque. And so, like, I think that the feature of recommendation is somewhat pernicious in today's world, and in part that's because these algorithms happen to be optimizing for attention. But I think that in any world where a platform is recommending a user content, that is a distortionary outcome, right? The platform is supplanting the volition of the user. And I think that the way that features contribute to harm isn't necessarily about the internals of how the feature optimizes. It's much more about what type of interaction patterns it unlocks and how those interaction patterns contribute to harms that can arise in that context.
So besides recommendation comments, what's like your third most?
Another really interesting one is identity, right? And so we tend to think of like the capacity of a user to log in a persistent way and kind of express facets of, you know, who they are. I think that that's a really interesting one. And it's interesting because there's not a right way or wrong way of doing it, but any approach to identity has really concrete trade-offs in harm. So a good example is something like age verification, right? There are, that's one of the kind of hot button topics right now in legislative circles. That has really concrete benefits in some ways on abuse harms, and really concrete downsides in terms of privacy and other forms of, you know, expressible content. And I think that identity is a great case where we have a lot of ways we can reason about how more or less representative identity systems can lead to or prevent harm, but there's not like a right answer there.
Okay, so just kind of wanted to take a step back and really understand what was your core motivation of this visiting fellowship, who's the intended audience, and what's the outcomes that you wanted to see out of all this beautiful work that you've done?
I think first for motivation, like when I was at Google, the biggest like headaches we had on counter abuse were not the result of like bad users doing bad things, but instead were the result of like poorly considered product decisions, right? So as a very basic example, when we launched Team Drives, we didn't enforce any storage quotas on them. And as a result, as you can imagine, we ended up paying out the nose for storage, and there were a huge range of abuses where like the counter abuse team was brought in to clean up behind a bad product decision. And we ended up, you know, doing a lot of stuff on TOS enforcement to try and, you know, ban accounts that were doing things that were against our terms of service, where the product allowed them to store that much storage, but it was like against, you know, the spirit of our TOS. And so we would take content moderation type efforts against them. In my like experience, a lot of the ways that integrity workers are expected to work is to clean up behind poor product decisions. And that makes me frustrated because I think that, you know, there's certainly a role for integrity in any world, but I don't love the world where integrity workers and, you know, integrity teams are kind of constantly on this defensive footing of trying to clean up the pollution of upstream business and product decisions. And I built this project to try and make that a little bit more legible to people who are not in the integrity space. Because I think that a lot of folks will come into thinking about content moderation with this idea of like, do you take the content down or do you not? Do you ban that user or do you not? And people are too infrequently, in my mind, asking the question, hey, why is hate speech super prevalent on this platform? Or why is spam such a significant issue here? Or why are scams proliferating here, right? And most of the time, you can actually attribute that pretty directly to a type of product decision that could be revised and could make integrity problems a lot better. And, you know, whether that's through voluntary platform action to try and make their systems healthier, or whether that's through legislation to try and enforce a better standard of operation in online spaces, I think there's a lot of ways that we can change or mandate change in product design that would have a huge impact on online harms.
Yeah, so there's one design decision that some would consider a feature. Like, I think like for Reddit, for example, Reddit's like main feature is being anonymous, quote unquote. And I'm assuming probably correctly that it leads to a ton of downstream harms. And I wouldn't consider this a reversible decision per se. So I kind of wanted to like get your thoughts on when can a platform reverse a certain platform decision and when they cannot.
Like on that specific question, like anonymity is a really broad spectrum. So there's sites like 4chan at kind of one end of that spectrum. And then there's kind of identity verified, like you have to upload a driver's license kind of platforms at the other end. And I think that like requiring differential access for differential types of usage is also totally reasonable. So, and you know, in the case of Reddit and anonymity, like maybe you want moderators to have a verified identity, even if you, you know, don't require that for average users. And maybe, you know, you don't allow people to sign up for more than a certain number of accounts, or, you know, you require some type of SMS verification to try and minimize the volume of accounts that people can generate, right? There's a lot of ways that like we shape identity in online spaces that have the potential to, you know, send clear signals about how important it is that you represent yourself as yourself. And so, I mean, that's like kind of the identity case, but like more broadly, we tend to think about features as being something that like a platform offers immutably, but often the only time that platforms change features is when like something is going pretty wrong in them. And I think that we need to have a little bit more of an open mind about ways that platforms could change or iterate or, you know, experiment with different types of features over time. And actually, I think Facebook, to their credit, has done a very good job over the last like decade of trying out a bunch of different things in terms of everything from like little banners under misinformation to rolling out other likes than the like button. And I think there's a lot of ways in which Facebook has iterated on platform design more effectively than a lot of other folks. And I think a lot of that comes from a willingness to experiment with the platform and see it as a malleable thing that changes over time, as opposed to a like kind of static set of features that are offered.
A bit earlier when you were saying there's a lot of effective categories of legislation we can see, can you go into that?
actually, through the Integrity Institute, I've met some legislators who have had some pretty interesting ideas about how to change the internet, and I've enjoyed working with them on that process. Part of what motivated this project was realizing that they need some mechanism to think through these issues in a kind of comprehensive way. And so part of the goal here was certainly a guide for regulators and legislators. I think that there's kind of three broad buckets of potential interventions that I would love to see legislation on. The first is kind of requiring options for user control, right? So the ways in which platforms operate today, the controls they offer to users are pretty discretionary, and they tend to not countervene the platform's financial interests. So platforms, you know, if you're asking what set of features are platforms going to offer to users around, for example, time limits, platforms are going to be really reticent to offer users any control over time limits if their business model relies on users spending a ton of time on their platform. And, you know, similarly, like if a platform's business model requires that they, you know, make really accurate predictions about users' behaviors, platforms are going to be really reticent to offer users options to reset those preferences or to reset the data that platforms know about them. And I think, you know, in both of those cases, I would love to see legislation that says actually any company in the world needs to offer a user a option to reset their profile, right? That sounds like a pretty straightforward, like no nonsense and achievable like legislative outcome that would actually offer users a lot more control and optionality over how they use those platforms. A second kind of broad category that I would love to see is requiring the collection of specific data in specific circumstances. So one of the things that has kind of frustrated me to no end is the idea that like anonymity on the internet is important in every context, as opposed to it's important in kind of contexts that are highly sensitive and personal. And I differentiate between those two because I think that it's really reasonable for people to want privacy and have expectations of privacy in, you know, one-on-one personal conversations, in the files that they store online, you know, in ways in which they are extending their digital selves online. In contrast, I think that when users are publishing online and when they are creating content that impacts or has the potential to be seen by hundreds of thousands of people, that there's a really different level of scrutiny that should be applied to those cases. And I think that there's a place for legislators to require the collection of things like IP address and device identifiers when users are, for example, uploading new media. And I think that there is room for that precisely because the ways in which sensitive information tends to be handled online is actually distinct from the ways that more public and more well-viewed content tends to be uploaded. The third kind of category I'd love to see is more kind of concrete intervention on the most harmful practices that we know are harmful for specific groups. And I am worried about a lot of things in the future, but I think how technology is impacting kids is at the top of that list, and how AI is going to influence the future of kind of peer-to-peer social media is also on that list. And I think in both of those cases, there's a role for legislators to require the design of features to help parents manage the amount of time or the types of content their children are engaging with. And similarly, requiring tools for users to be able to navigate content to understand its provenance and understanding whether or not it is generated by an AI system or whether it's legitimate. And I think in both of those cases, I think there's a real need for legislative action because these tools are hard to build. They're really hard to do cross-platform. And if you want an effective solution, you need to have kind of an industry-wide solution. Without that type of legislative intervention, I don't think we're going to get any tools to discern truth from reality on social media. And I don't think kids are going to get any tools to help them navigate social media or more broadly, like internet platforms better.
If a legislator were hearing this episode today, what would be like the general takeaways from this? And then I also remember that your other intended audience is software engineers. What would be a general takeaway for them?
Yeah, for sure. So kind of first going with that question about, you know, what a legislator should take away. I think my first like thought there is that legislators should think about what types of functionality they could require platforms to offer that would make users' experience concretely better. And I think the EU has started to do this in GDPR with things like you have to offer users the ability to delete all of their data. Like that is an option the EU mandates. I think that legislators could think about similar things around you have to offer a concrete, hard time limit to your users that they can set in advance that they cannot override, right? That is a straightforward regulation that would allow children, but also adults, to set much better boundaries in how they interact with technology than they're able to do today. And that's also the type of thing that will never happen without, you know, legislative action.
So the option to have time limits or hard time limits?
The option to have hard time limits that can't be overridden, right? So this would be something like, you know I spend a lot of time on Reddit. I would love if Reddit could offer me an option to use it for 10 minutes a day and then turn off after that. Stop serving requests to my IP address, right? Like there's a bunch of ways in which systems that these platforms offer for time limitation are intentionally easy to override. Right. They all have a little button that's like, hey, you're at your time limit. And then people are just like, yeah, I guess I'll just click that button now. It overrides it. And I think that kind of feature can't exist in a company that's like ultimately bottom line is the attention economy and trying to maximize the amount of time users spend on content.
Yeah, you bring up some interesting like philosophical items here. One is the extension of digital self. And then two is user control.
Yeah.
And they're like slightly related, but also slightly different. My mini rant right now is basically that like YouTube shorts shouldn't be allowed.
You should have the option. You should have the option to say, I don't want to see YouTube shorts, right? Yes. Like that's important. And like, I ultimately had to leave Instagram this year. Because like yeah. I loved Instagram as a way of sharing photos from myself to my friends. I loved yes. seeing my friends' photos. I yes. hated the fact that more and more of the content interjected into that was like content that, yeah, is appealing to me, but not how I want to spend my time, right? And like I think that there's this race to the bottom in terms of content that grabs people's attention and keeps them there that is like deeply unhealthy for us, and that I think most people who are pretty online feel like it's unhealthy for them, but there are no tools that I'm aware of that like are actually effective at dealing with this problem, because all of the platforms have every incentive to circumvent those tools and to create mechanisms by which you are either compelled to engage with the more attention-grabby content, or if you don't want to engage with it, you can't engage with the pieces that bring you meaning.
Exactly. So like I had to delete Instagram. I had a love-hate relationship with TikTok, so I finally just deleted it for good. And now yeah. it's like YouTube. Like YouTube, I enjoyed long-form content. And that was a great thing about mid-YouTube was yeah. the content got longer. Because the longer totally. The content was, the more ad revenue they can get out of it. And the incentives were aligned for attention yeah. span, I guess, for lack of a better term. So yeah, YouTube Shorts, that's like my big thing right now. Like I shouldn't have to have a platform force a slot machine yes. on me.
Yeah, and I mean like... I think my general gripe with like proactive content recommendation stuff, right? It comes back to that thing you mentioned earlier about volition or like, you know, user control. I think there's something deeply insidious about the way that platforms try to manipulate how you spend your time. Like it's one thing if you say, okay, I want to log onto this platform. I want to see updates from my friends. I want to post updates to my friends. It's a like, pretty different thing if you log on to a box where you have literally no idea what's going to be in it. And all your promise is that it's going to be entertaining and that you're going to like it. And like, that's a really different, like the origination of the volition there is entirely with the platform, right? TikTok and YouTube Shorts and Instagram Reels, all of these platforms have one thing in common, which is that the user has truly no control. And like, that to me seems pernicious. And it is also, in my experience, something I don't enjoy the long-term feeling of. Like, I find it entertaining, but it is like connected to me to a sense of like despair and not feeling good about the state of the world and feeling kind of powerless. And I that feels connected to me. It's not a surprise to me that when you spend a lot of time on social media apps that don't give you any control, that you feel powerless.
Yeah, I think that this concept of user autonomy. I vaguely remember some Black Mirror episode about it where someone gets like transported to some object or something like that, and that object only has like two available emotions they're allowed to express, or like a teddy bear or something like that. And the legal requirement is they have to be able to express five emotions. And I was just like, okay, like this is quite translatable to, like, is it the case that our platform should always allow a user to extend themselves through that platform and or allow for a lot of user control in that platform that's supposed to be personalizable? I'm not entirely sure. And then if that's the case, if there's a lot more user control, is there also implications for how much identity should be involved as well?
One of the things I love is dystopian fiction. Like, I think dystopian fiction is like the most useful tool we have for thinking about technology in the future, because it's really hard from like the day-to-day of existing in this world and like interacting with new technologies to appreciate or think about the ways that these things change over time and change us over time and change the way we interact over time. And like, I've been reading a lot of dystopian fiction over the last few years. And I think a really good frame for most legislation is like, what dystopia does this legislation prevent? Or like, you know, if you start with a dystopian novel that you agree is an awful outcome, what type of earlier intervention in a democratic society could have prevented that outcome? And I actually think that's a pretty helpful way of thinking through like questions of legislation and like, you know, democratic expression.
Yeah, dystopian novels are fun, but it's just like when I read it, I'm like, I'm trying to like leave the world, not like get back into it with a different perception. So to each their own. That's why you need user control. This is why you need user control. I don't pick a bookshop. Like the bookshop doesn't pick a book for me. Anyways, to go back to the original intent, I also wanted to ask what like are some general takeaways that someone new to trust and safety, someone maybe making a product manager or maybe like a software engineer working on a new product or a startup founder working on a new startup, what should they think about when, what are the general, like what's a good framework for them to be like, oh, okay, here's A, here's B, here's C, here's D, and now I've done a lot of more trust and safety than most.
Yeah, really good question. And I think that this is like, all of these lessons are pretty hard won and hard fought, right? I think a good first one is that literally nothing should ever be unlimited. Like in any system, you need to offer limits because you don't want your users to use up all of your resources. You don't want users to run roughshod over each other, and you don't want to be monopolized by a few users. Like in any platform, you need limits, and those limits need to be confined to what the business use case is for the user, right? If you don't want people to, you know, post 800,000 times a day, you need to have a limit that they can't post more than 799,000 times, right? And otherwise users will do it. And I've found that like limits as an expression of like a platform's expectations are a really powerful tool that software engineers and product managers can use to minimize the potential for abuse. A kind of second one is a little counterintuitive, and it sounds a little scary, but like I think platforms should not treat users equally, and that is okay. And when I say that, I don't mean that, you know, platforms should discriminate between viewpoints or ideas, but just that like different users have a different level of trust within a platform, and that should result in commensurate levels of like responsibility and capability. So great example is, you know, YouTube a few years ago rolled out kind of live streaming features, and they realized that they didn't want people to do things like live stream massacres, which happened during Christchurch, right? And so the way that they built in tools to prevent that was to try and make a reputation-based system where a user who has a long history of posting content on YouTube that has not been flagged, and a user who, you know, has commented and interacted and watched videos in a way that is kind of commensurate with typical user behavior, is more highly trusted and can initiate a live stream, whereas someone who created their account 20 minutes ago is not able to create a live stream. And that type of differentiation of product behavior based on level of like implicit trust from a platform is a really powerful way of preventing powerful features from being misused while still allowing users to access those powerful features. And then kind of hand in hand with that one is, I think most platforms don't actually want to allow robots on their platform. Like maybe there are some exceptions to this, and those exceptions should be kind of well thought through. But most of the time, we're building technology for humans, and we intend for it to be used by humans. And when it is not being used by humans, it is a signal of abuse, whether that is spam, malware, phishing, you know, you name it. Robot activity tends to be really, really highly correlated with misuse and abuse. And so platforms should do a ton on the developer side to make sure that they are interacting with humans and use systems like reCAPTCHAs and other types of, you know, signal checking to verify that the entity on the other end of the wire is a person, and that person is the same person over time. And I think that can do a huge amount to combat a bunch of different types of abuse. And then kind of the last piece is, I think as software engineers, you know, I was a software engineer for many years, and ultimately what I ended up doing on my team at Google ended up looking a lot more like product management. But a lot of that was because I started asking the question, like, should we be doing this? And, you know, is this a good idea? And I think that, like, software engineers need a little bit more, like, power and a little bit more confidence to ask those types of questions. Because, you know, when you as a software engineer speak up and say, actually, should we be doing this? If we do this, we were likely to see these types of harms downstream. I think that, like, when they have a voice in that conversation, they're able to head off a lot of these problems, because as software engineers, you have a kind of view of the technical elements of things and the likely outcomes from changing those technical elements that people in product management don't always have and people in executive roles don't always have.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone in trust and safety ends up being like a little bit of a product manager because of this, or everyone that's a little passionate about it. You're the one that notices the trends, notices making users happy, but like maybe the opposite, making adversaries angry.
Yes. Well put.
I kind of want to go back to what we were chatting about earlier about this trade-off between privacy and integrity. And you worked at Google Drive for a bit, and I'm assuming there were quite a bit of trade-offs. Like if someone uploads a file to Google Drive and then downloads it back, should any check be happening? And there's been another recent LinkedIn kerfuffle, I don't know what you want to call it, about where CSAM lies in this mix, in this, like, oh, should Apple be scanning devices for CSAM? Should they not? Yeah. So just kind of want to understand what's your thought process around here for as someone that's worked in the space for quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think my background pre-working in integrity was actually on privacy. I worked on GDPR implementation, and I was an engineer working on kind of privacy reviews for a bit. And I came to integrity work with a pretty privacy-focused mindset. And so I've always kind of applied that lens to think about trade-offs and where those trade-offs are warranted and where they're not. And I think that the question of scrutiny that a scanning approach takes is a pretty helpful lens here. And so what I mean by scrutiny is that something like hash matching, where you're saying, does this file match the exact file we have taken down before, is possibly like the least invasive form of scanning content for abusive material. So if we have taken down a piece of content in the past for being malware, and that content had some specific hash, if we see those exact same bytes again, it's malware, right? And that type of analysis requires no additional context to evaluate. It requires no, it doesn't tell you about the actual contents of the content. And so there are checks like hash scanning that I feel are pretty innocuous on even personally held content. On kind of the other end of the spectrum, there are human reviews, which sometimes go to multiple reviewers, where content is actually shown to someone else. And we ask them, is this content violative of any of our policies? And that is, you know, obviously the most expansive and extensive form of scanning that a platform can perform. And in cases where platforms do that, there are innumerable like privacy harms and kind of potential concrete harms for folks with marginalized identities or marginalized political views. And so I like to think of like scanning techniques as having some level of intrusiveness along that spectrum. And you can kind of plot out, you know, 10 to 15 different types of scanning along that spectrum. And then similarly, you can think about the amount of privacy a user expects through their activity. And so, you know, if a user is uploading a file for their personal use, they never share it with anyone else, it's a really different use case than if they are sharing it with one person. And that's a really different use case than if they're sharing it with 20 people. And that's a pretty different use case than if they're publishing it to the web. And my general thought is that the user who uploads a file and holds it privately, it has a really strong expectation of privacy. And the user who uploads the file and makes it visible to the web doesn't really expect much privacy. And that, you know, using more invasive forms of scanning on content that is more public or more broadly shared is a pretty solid mechanism for balancing these two obligations to privacy and curation. And, you know, that is a perspective that a lot of platforms should take because their users don't use the platform in the same way, right? So a user who is exclusively watching videos on it or, you know, lurking and never creates an account has a really different expectation of privacy than a user who posts a lot or creates a lot of comments or has even created an account and likes things, right? Like through actions, users can describe their preferences around privacy. And I think platforms best balance like privacy and curatorial obligations when they listen to the signals that users send about what their expectations are.
So I think one thing I'm hearing is that from the user behavior, you can kind of discern their intentionality.
Yeah.
And from the intentionality, you can prescribe a certain set of mitigations for that behavior pattern.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so if we get a little bit concrete into this, so I just let me start off with like the most one-to-one correspondent, a one-to-one, not even one-to-one, like you and yourself. So the, an extension of digital self. And the way that I'm thinking about this is like, I'm just trying to understand is like, what is a good trade-off as we go along the spectrum? And I'm kind of defining it as one is your digital self. Two is one-to-one chat. Three is your group chats. Four is Facebook group. And yeah. I don't know, like go from there.
That is, by the way, almost exactly how I think about this.
Okay, cool. Good to know. So yeah. So for extension of digital self, say you're storing something locally on laptop, you're storing something on Apple Photos. Should something hash scanning exist for that?
In my mind, I think hash scanning is a pretty reasonable approach for that. But I actually think it's mostly from a, you know, protecting a user situation. So, you know, users are broadly supportive of platforms' attempts to scan for malware, phishing, and spam. And I think that, you know, users want their file storage systems to have malware detections built in. I also think that offering that kind of control to users would be totally reasonable in that type of context, right? Because in a situation that, as you said, like is kind of an extension of the digital self, the platform is playing a purely like functional role for the user and is not really contributing to potential harm. So if the platform wants to offer features that allow users to, you know, scan their own content for malware, that feels totally innocuous to me. But if a platform is scanning that content for copyrighted material to take DMCA notices, like that feels really different, right? And I think that like within that one to self context, I very much support like privacy to pretty much an extreme.
Got it. To ask the controversial question,
yeah.
Would CSAM scanning also be an option for the user, for digital self?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think it really depends on the role of the application, right? So if the application is, let's say, a photo capturing application, and it is doing a, you know, and it is trying to assess whether or not the image being captured represents child sexual abuse imagery, like, that seems like a really different question than if it is a file storage or a backup solution, right? And the reason that there's kind of a distinction there is like, one, thinking about the routes that potential child sexual abuse imagery could take in being a part of an application or being at a point where it could be scanned, it matters, right? And so doing hash matching for known CSAM on a, you know, on a chip inside a camera does nothing, right? Because if the camera is being used to capture CSAM, it's novel CSAM. And similarly, doing hash matching scans on, you know, a backup solution actually has a pretty high likelihood of catching CSAM if the user has CSAM on their device, because for whatever reason, people who collect CSAM tend to collect a lot of it. And so the possibility of a backup solution via hash matching actually catching something are pretty high. And so in my mind, like, it's not just a question of what the user's privacy expectations are, but also what the potential avenue is for solvency and whether or not the privacy implications are sufficiently caustic. So another good example here is like, what is the hash matching set used and how is it contributed to? You know, whether or not you're hash matching for copyright or for CSAM or for malware, they're pretty similar systems. And, you know, there are specific systems that you can use for CSAM or specific systems you can use for malware detection. But when you're just thinking about file level properties, that's not necessarily a significant distinction. And so I like to also think about how would a totalitarian regime try to co-opt the system? And is there a way we can build systems or is there a way we can build enforcement such that it is useful for the things that we think are important and not helpful for the things that we think are potential overreaches?
Got it. Okay, cool. So that's the extension of digital self. What about one-to-one conversation? Should be encrypted, should not be encrypted. And whatever the answer of that is, should metadata be stored?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think there's a good case to be made here on either side of that. I think this is kind of it's the inflection point, right? As soon as we get into kind of one-to-many communication, I think the expectations of privacy break down pretty considerably. One-to-one communication is, I think, still a space that people have a lot of expectations of privacy, but not necessarily complete ones. I think also that doesn't necessarily need to be an all or one thing. So one thing that you could imagine a system that does messaging doing is starting to scan content when it is sent to more than three people, right? So like if you and I are one-on-one messaging and every message we send is unique, that's a pretty distinct interaction paradigm than if I am sending the same party invitation to 20 of my close friends, each of them in a one-to-one message. And so I think there's like ways we can be intelligent about this that don't allow kind of easy workarounds that still do provide a lot of robust protections for one-to-one messaging.
What about like metadata scanning, generally speaking? Like scanning for, this is like a net coordinate, like for counterterrorism, okay? They generally are like metadata scanned and that's how you're able to figure out where the networks of like coordinated bad actors, whatever you want to call them. How does that kind of tie in with privacy?
I think the distinction between primary content and metadata is like a pretty false one. Like I think that you can discern almost more incriminating stuff from metadata than you probably can from primary content. And I don't really think that they should be held to distinct standards in terms of, their sensitivity. I think that in particular, when like metadata is aggregated, it actually has the capacity to tell more precise stories about how a user thinks and who they are than the content that they generate. And that to me feels important for us to kind of erase that distinction, because I think a lot of very invasive things hide behind that distinction. So, ISPs selling your traffic data saying, oh, it's just metadata about what sites you visited and when. It doesn't tell you what the site contained. It's like, yeah, but if I went to, a site for like insert, sexual kink here, like there's a lot you can infer from that. And I think that that distinction does more harm than good. And we should really think about, does this person have access to the thing that I am doing or not? And what are the regulations that govern how that is used?
So yeah, enough about privacy and integrity. I kind of want to, while I was doing some research for the podcast, I saw some fun art projects that you've had.
Oh yeah, nice.
Would love to chat about that if you're up for it.
Oh my God, I'm always down. Yeah, let's talk about
it. Okay, please. Yeah, I saw some of the tests, like some of the cool visualizations you made. Would love to hear what you think about and how you're thinking about these things. Is it just more of like a Rick Rubin, I'm kind of tapping into the universe, or is it more like I want to code it up because it looks cool? It's hard to code up, and it's more like intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, great question. So I'm a huge geometry nerd. I love geometry, and I like really enjoyed it in high school. I enjoyed it in college. I'm a math major, and I just really love thinking about how shapes happen and like how shapes interact and like what assemblages of shapes are pleasant to look at and which aren't. And I love thinking about that within the context of a lot of modern art. So like, I think I first got into generative art when I was probably around like late high school, early college. And I love art museums, but I would go and I would think about, okay, what would a computer need to do to generate that? Like, what are the like fundamental shapes? What are the like contrasts, and how is it that that image could come to be? And so I started working on a couple of projects that were like kind of purely copying, you know, here's an awesome work by an artist I like. I want to see if I can build code that writes it. And from there, I kind of have just fallen deeper and deeper down rabbit holes of like Euclidean geometry in particular. I think the fact that you can make almost anything from a straight edge and compass is one of the coolest things in the world. And I love pushing the boundaries of that and trying to build algorithms to do it. And actually, so typically when I do these projects, I find that like writing the algorithm is part of the fun. And then the more fun part is tinkering with it. So like trying to tune the parameters to see like how things change as you change, like, oh, this, you know, delta variable a little bit, like how does that impact the ultimate outcome? And so a friend and I created a site that actually is like incredibly generalizable to this problem, where an artist can upload a Docker image and specify what types of flags it takes in and like what the allowed values are for that. And then it allows anyone in the world to run those algorithms. So the URL is abound.art. I encourage you and everyone else to check it out. But I think there's like 20 different algorithms that I've written on it. And with each one, you can kind of see the outputs, and then you can like clone the seeds of each of those outputs to create new images that are similar, or like tweak it to your own preferred specifications. I had so much fun building it, and I haven't built a new art algorithm in like a year. So it's definitely overdue.
Yeah. Time to get back now that you're finished with the fellowship, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the kind of person who's working on 6-month side projects all the time. And like the fellowship was the last one. The one before that was Abound. And my next one is actually going to be pop-up books. I really like pop-up books, and I'm writing some code to try and automatically procedurally generate pop-up books that are in the shape of mountains.
Wait, so pop-up books on like on a laptop, or like where is the code generating coming in here?
I want to be able to take in a topographic map and then generate a series of cuts that can be cut out on a Cricut, which is like just a machine for like essentially cutting out from paper specific lines. And then I want to be able to 3D print a roller for indenting and dedenting it, so that when you fold it, it turns into a pop-up of that mountain. That is my end goal. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And like I love mountains, and I also love pop-up books. So I'm excited to see where this one takes me.
I'm excited to see where it goes as well. So like, this is pretty cool. That's number one. But number two is like, yeah, I mean, I feel like there's this art and integrity and like privacy or whatever you want to call it. I don't know. Like, do you kind of see that intersection, or are you kind of like, nah, this is like totally different than my work?
I think they're very similar things, right? Like, I think part of the reason I am so focused on design in systems is that like, that's the fun part of things, right? I think figuring out how you design a system to do what you want, or design a system to be better or generate less harm, like, is to me the same process of figuring out like, what series of cuts do you need to make in paper to make it make a beautiful shape? And like, I think there's something really similar about, you know, trying to understand the dynamics of social networks, or understand the dynamics of paper, or understand the dynamics of like filling spaces that make something beautiful or useful or harmful. Right? And like, in each of those cases, I feel like I like understanding those dynamics and then trying to exercise that understanding through changing inputs, changing cuts on paper, changing the design of social networks such that you get better outcomes.
I see. And just out of my own curiosity, like, what shapes are pleasing to look at?
Oh,
like, have you found the answer to that yet?
I think that one's probably a little too long of a question to answer in a podcast, but I tend to really enjoy shapes where there is a rhythm to them that you can understand, but without that being explicit. So like, I think the best like procedurally generated art is stuff where you look at it and there is a sense for this makes sense. This has some underlying logic to it, but it's not necessarily obvious what that logic is. So like, I think bad procedurally generated art tends to be like way overly obvious. It's a series of squares, and each square is cut with like, you know, the same triangle or whatever. I think the best like procedurally generated art has enough layers of either obfuscation or creativity that you can't see the underlying pattern of how it was made, but you can still appreciate that there's like a rhythm to it, that it makes some sense, you know?
Is that the case for beauty, generally speaking, for you?
Yeah, maybe, because I love nature. I love spending time in nature. And I think part of the thing I love about it is nature follows rhythms that are not necessarily obvious, but when you look closely enough or you think hard enough or you read enough, they become visible and legible. And so I think that like the way nature operates is largely similar, right? Where there is an underlying rhythm to all of nature, but it's very hard to grok that immediately. You have to kind of deeply think about it, or you have to, you know, read about it and learn about it. And I think that like beauty comes like from our appreciation of and engagement with nature. So that's my thought there.
And that's a great way to end the show. Any final thoughts before?
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for asking me questions about, the variety of interesting hobbies I like to do.
You like to do a lot, so it's pretty cool that you are doing what you're doing. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And long-time listener, first-time caller. So thanks for...
Nice.
Yeah.
Always good to hear.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please share this episode to your friends so we can continue making episodes like this. Today's episode was produced by me, Talha Baig. Music by Zhao Shen. And special thanks to Sahar, Cass, Rachel, and Sean for their continued support.